Sometimes it feels like the world is moving at hyperspeed and you can't keep up because it's one thing, then another, and don't forget the meeting and the yoga class and the dinner reservation, but then you get into the all-new Nissan Murano, and you feel the breeze from the panoramic moonroof, while the massaging seats melt away the tension of the day. And you realize that sometimes the greatest rush is not rushing at all. Shop the all-new Murano at NissanUSA.com. Panoramic moonroof, massaging leather appointed seats are available features. Sometimes it feels like the world is moving at hyperspeed and you can't keep up because it's one thing, then another, and don't forget the meeting and the yoga class and the dinner reservation, but then you get into the all-new Nissan Murano, and you feel the breeze from the panoramic moonroof, while the massaging seats melt away the tension of the day. And you realize that sometimes the greatest rush is not rushing at all. Shop the all-new Murano at NissanUSA.com. Panoramic moonroof, massaging leather appointed seats are available features.
Women to Watch is an intimate look into the lives of prominent and influential women leaders from around the world and the challenges they faced on their journey. It's the real story behind her title. Join us every week to hear more stories about women from around the world and in your own communities at womentowatch.net. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch. I'm Sue Rocco. Thanks so much for tuning in. Joining me in just a moment will be Kimberly McGlon, and Kimberly is the founder and CEO of Grant Boulevard. She's a faculty member for Drexel University here in Philadelphia, and she's also the Social Impact Senior Vice President at the Fittler Club. She's going to be sharing with us her story, her beginning growing up in Milwaukee, and overcoming some significant challenges in her upbringing. As always, stay with us during the breaks, where you'll hear from our exclusive watch team of corporate partners, bringing you news and information from their industries. And I always want to invite you to subscribe to our YouTube channel at W2W Media, where you can watch the show rather than the podcast. So now I'm very honored and excited to welcome to the show Kimberly McGlon. Kimberly, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be with you today.
It's great to have you. I'm excited to bring forth your personal life story as well as all the great work you've been doing. And of course, I think I'm so particularly impressed with what you've accomplished and done. Because of your beginning, it was challenging for you. And I think, as you and I spoke about before, so much of who we are begins where we came from. And I wanted to open up the interview and just talk a little bit about the challenges you faced during your upbringing in Milwaukee. You were born in Milwaukee, and your mom and dad had challenges of their own. Mm-hmm. And if you can share with us how that has impacted pretty much, you know, the work that you're doing now.
Yeah. I think that this idea of how do we examine, find peace with, make peace with our beginnings is so crucial to how we lead, you know, the way that we approach leadership, the values that we bring into our leadership. And that's certainly true for me. My childhood growing up in Milwaukee was two things. It was the middle class and the safety of the middle class, and it was also an experience with just collapse. And I think that idea of figuring out how to navigate the world as a kid, as a very, very young adult, it has informed everything I've sought to do as an adult, for sure.
Can I ask you what your when things were collapsing around you, mm-hmm. what was your sense of self? I know that you had a support system, an incredible support system of women, and I want to give you an opportunity to talk about them and I guess how they were a safety net for you.
Yeah. And I think on the inward side, I love books. I was a woman, Susan, who just loved, I was a girl who loved to read. I found pieces of myself in all of the stories I read as a child. And I think that for me, the belief that there were other worlds, that there were ways of creating other worlds, stories like the Phantom Toll Booth and Choose Your Own Adventure, they just freed me up. They just opened up my aperture for seeing what was possible in alternative realities. And I think that for me, that really catalyzed a sense of open-mindedness about the possibilities that I was able to kind of stand on as I took risks and just continue to always leap into the unknown.
Let's talk about the women you were surrounded by. You described them as the women who have shaped your compass. Mm-hmm. Who in particular?
So many. I think one is my English teachers, you know, Miss Anton, who was my English teacher my junior year when I was really actually on my own. She had so much grace with me. There were lots of assignments I didn't complete and lots of days I didn't come to school. And she didn't punish me for that. And she represented the voice of an Asian American woman who was very present in my life. And then there was my guidance counselor, Miss Brunson, who was a white woman. I write about her in my first book about her raspy voice. And she was just like she was a smoker. And she was very clear that I was gonna make it. And she was tough and firm with me. And then there was Umi, who black woman who was really much so into sensual self-expression and freedom and self-possession and self-ownership. And she just was just like, you know, very clear that I could define myself. And I think that particular symphony of women, they contributed so much to the landscape of my personality.
I love when someone kind of comes into your life and sees parts of you that maybe you don't see yet or don't believe in.
They're gifts. They're for sure gifts.
At what point did you start to have aspirations to be a teacher?
You know, I've thought about this a little bit recently. I think I was probably around maybe 9 or 10. I was the oldest of 3 girls. And in the summers, beginning about 10, 11, it was my job to kind of map out the curriculums for summer school for my sisters. Oh. And so I...
You were already teaching at 9. Teaching.
Yeah. And for those of you who remember when Walgreens and when they used to carry the workbooks, like the, you know, like the math workbooks and the English supplements, you could get them at the pharmacy. And so I would go in there and I would decide what we were going to study in the summer. And so, and I would assign work and I would grade work and I would give feedback. So in that way, I've been teaching since I was like 10 years old.
Wow. Is your love of literature something that you discovered on your own, or did somebody encourage that? You know, reading, it's so incredibly important. But I think some children are born up with books all around and people instilling the love of reading. And sometimes kids find it on their own for a little bit for what you said, kind of as an escape.
Yeah, no, for me, they were very available to me. You know, in that first part of my childhood, my parents bought a home that had a library. It was a room dedicated with the whole house is designed in the Frank Lloyd Wright style. So lots of wood and lots of glass work and lots of really handcrafted plaster work, like on the ceiling. And in the library, there were shelves and shelves of books behind glass panels. And so I grew up in a home where there were books everywhere. Both of my parents were curious people. My mother in particular was a voracious reader. And we went to the library really, really often. So I was an early reader, and my parents, as readers themselves, they really normalized that there was safety for all of us in learning. And so that was something that was with me very, very early on, very, very early on.
And how were you as a student? I'm assuming good, because you went on to get a PhD. No, yes.
Yes,
right? English.
Yes, I was that was the only class I always got A's in, was English.
Okay.
Even when I was missing weeks of school, which was something that happened in my junior and my senior year of school, I missed weeks of school. And that meant that I barely graduated from high school, as it were. I barely graduated. I had to do summer school for math, and I failed physics, and I graduated with just a little over a 2.0. Mostly because of absences. I didn't have, you know, high school for me, you know, I talked about my childhood and my parents' presence in my early childhood, but by 14, I was basically on my own. And so at that point, I really didn't go to school very much. And wow. So it was only because of the grace of those couple of teachers and my test scores that I was able to get into college. But it's not a gross exaggeration to say I barely graduated from high school.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk a little bit about what kept you from high school and, you know, how you managed I think not having, even in high school, you know, we're kind of becoming adults, mm-hmm. but we're so, that's tough mm-hmm. time, especially for young women. Mm-hmm. And to not have the security of the parents there fully, you know, well themselves, I think is a really tough thing.
It is a tough thing. And I think for so many of us, you know, for me, it was a case where my parents were both, they were both alive and they were both absent. So, and they were absent for different reasons. And that their disappearance started to happen when I was about 14, basically tied to some mental health challenges, emotional health challenges, and substance abuse. And so while they went from being really hardworking, very focused people, those crises that happened in both of their lives at the same time, it just meant that I was a kid without parents. And so, you know, the idea of figuring out how to get to school and how to stay in school and staying motivated when there was really no one I was accountable to, that I just kind of, in that moment, in that absence, I got swallowed up in the gulf of just, you know, I don't even know what to call that, you know, lots of, you know, yeah. drinking and lots of, you know, just being out and just having a feral experience, really, quite frankly. I was just on my own, just kind of bopping around. And if it wasn't for those women, then I would have gotten lost to that circumstance. But there were, like I said, those women, they were very clear with me. And this is the power of having women in your life and having gratitude for women, is that they mothered me. In the absence of my biological parents, those women, they totally stepped up and they sheltered me and they guided me and they provided for me.
Yeah. Would you say where you sit today, you've accomplished so much, but you have a long way to go. You're young. Have you made peace with that time in your life? Can you see it for what it is and you know, just to make peace with it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that circumstance was another classroom for me of understanding human nature and that none of us are heroes or villains. And in that way, I think that for me, there's been a lot of peace. I have a particularly beautiful relationship with my father. He and I are very close. He's incredibly supportive. My dad has always been a feminist, even when he was ill, you know, like having a substance abuse issue. That challenge, it's not a, I came to not see it as a personal failure. I see it as it's a physiological, psychological challenge. And so he's remarkably successful, despite all of those years that, you know, time just kind of passed him by in a blur. He's recovered and he is able to show up for me and for my daughter in really amazing ways. And you know, I think for both of my parents, it's seeing, as my daughter will have to come to see for me and those of who are watching who are parents, that we are all individuals navigating a lot of inheritances. And I think that for me, what that taught me was to really hold more space to see complexity, to see that it's complex, that it's not just, you know, it is this or it isn't that. No, when it comes to us navigating being alive, a lot of things happen at the same time. And our parents are people with names and histories and mm-hmm. their own traumas. And I think that for me, that's where I found peace, is in that. Isn't that
understanding? Yes. Your dad had a whole story of his own before he came to be your father. Yes. Right. You're so right about that. The history of people's journeys and stories is really complex.
It is. And there's all the things that our parents do tell us. And then there's the things our parents don't tell us. There's the things that they're able to hide from us. And they're the things that sometimes they can't hide even when they wish they could. And I think that for me, it's just that going back to that word grace, you know, that, you know, accepting that I, as a parent, I really am efforting every day to do my best. And I give my parents grace that was what they were trying to do. And it's what they continue to do. And that's all we can ask for. That's ultimately all we're going to get.
Yes. Now, something else, another, I would say, impactful experience of your life was you mentioned your daughter, having her at 21, getting married and then divorced. That's, you know, that's another heavy thing. It's an emotional experience. When you look at your daughter today, do you look at her and think, well, that was hard. I went through that, but here you are, and here I am as a proud mother.
Yeah, I was actually reflecting with her today in my classroom at Drexel University, and I was encouraging my students to reflect on. It's not really necessarily related to class, but I always open my teaching practice with a grounding in, you know, how are you? Every class opens with that question. I ask my design students, my fashion students, how are you? And I give them some time to sit with that, and then I ask the second question that just gives them space to kind of find new language for their feelings and also more confidence around sharing their feelings. So the second question today was, what are you celebrating and how are you celebrating? And so we just held space for the need to celebrate. And I said, I'm celebrating the fact that, you know, my daughter was diagnosed with kidney disease when she was 8. And I had her when I was 28. So I got married when I was 21, but I didn't have her until I was 28.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No worries. But I say that to say that when she was 8, she was diagnosed with kidney disease, and she spent about 10 days in the ICU at CHOP, the hospital here in Philadelphia. And tonight she's traveling to Boston so that she can compete for the first time in nationals in the 800. She's a track athlete. She's a wonderful student and an incredible athlete. And I'm so proud of her own journey. And she's taught me so much. And I think as women who have had the experience of motherhood, regardless of the circumstance, our kids come to teach us a lot. And I've certainly learned a lot from her about fortitude and endurance and about grit. You know, the event that she runs is really hard. And I'm really grateful that, you know, as someone who got married really young, and I understand why I got married really young, and that's another thing I've made peace with, Susan. I also am very proud of the daughter that I've raised and how hard she's working to go after her own dreams.
I'm sure she's, you know, you can have all the conversations and you're very close, but she sees what you have done, and, you know, you're a living example. Right. So all the things you talk about, you're doing those. So, you know, that's a big part of being a good mother, I would say.
I think so, too. And I think, too, for those of us who have been in seasons of perhaps hyperachievement or just a real sense of eagle-eyed focus on what we want to accomplish professionally. I think there's another thing about having to make sure that she understands that there's a season for pressure, and there's a season for moving with a sense of urgency. And then there are other seasons where your life becomes more dedicated to creative pursuits and to volunteer to service. And sometimes we can build lives where all of those things are happening at one time. And sometimes there are seasons of, like, you know, drive, and then seasons of rest. So I hope she's learning all of that.
Yeah, I'm sure she is. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to get into your professional career and your businesses and your focus on environment and social impact, all that good stuff. Stay with us as we go into our break, where you'll hear from our exclusive watch team of corporate partners. And we'll be back with Kimberly McGlon.
Okay, girls, today I'm giving you the inside scoop on my favorite place to save this spring. At Ross, it's the spot to get everything you need at prices you'll love. Because when you find brand names for 20 to 60% off other retailers' prices, you'll definitely be finding your next favorite outfit and more. Trust me, you don't want to miss out on these deals on your favorite dresses and tops. And at this price, you might as well throw in a new purse or pair of shoes too. But Ross isn't just about savings. They're about giving back. This year, Ross and their customers raised over $4.1 million to support the Boys and Girls Clubs and local youth programs to help kids and families thrive. Seriously, just visit your local Ross and see for yourself, because I know you like to keep your closet full and your costs low. So what are you waiting for? Say yes for less at your local Ross.
Sometimes it feels like the world is moving at hyperspeed and you can't keep up because it's one thing, then another, and don't forget the meeting and the yoga class and the dinner reservation, but then you get into the all-new Nissan Murano.
and you feel the breeze from the panoramic moonroof, while the massaging seats melt away the tension of the day. And you realize that sometimes the greatest rush is not rushing at all. Shop the all-new Murano at NissanUSA.com. Panoramic moonroof massaging leather appointed seats are available features. Sometimes it feels like the world is moving at hyperspeed and you can't keep up because it's one thing, then another, and don't forget the meeting and the yoga class and the dinner reservation, but then you get into the all-new Nissan Murano, and you feel the breeze from the panoramic moonroof, while the massaging seats melt away the tension of the day. And you realize that sometimes the greatest rush is not rushing at all. Shop the all-new Murano at NissanUSA.com. Panoramic moonroof massaging leather appointed seats are available features.
As a female-led organization, you have to bring it every single day. We're a mashup of sort of right and left brain. So we're not just doing management consulting. We're not just doing creative services. We're not just producing an event, but we're bringing a comprehensive solution to our clients. And because of the way we approach it, we end up being bought into what it is that we're doing in a way that we truly have as much skin in the game as our clients do, whether it's bringing affordable internet to communities across the Caribbean, or it's helping Comcast with their Internet Essentials program, which is something we've been very proud to work on, or it's helping the NFL celebrate their centennial season by getting 1 million people to give at least 100 minutes to causes they care about, or helping the city of Philadelphia win the World Cup. So what's next for us? Well, we just hit just over 100 employees. I think we are at that tipping point, and I don't think there's anybody that does it better than we do. I'm Maggie Wilkinson, CEO of Athena Global Advisors, a company that is proudly based in Philadelphia.
Ladies, I'm Tiffany Curtin, a financial professional with more than 25 years of experience serving successful women, families, and businesses. Here's the reality. You don't have to be the one managing your family's finances to take ownership of your future. But if you want true confidence about how everything is going to play out, you do have to take part in the process. That doesn't mean digging the weeds of your finances when you don't have the time or desire. It means elevating your awareness of your own circumstances. It means having the bigger conversations so you're empowered when you need to be. Let's bring confidence to your family's future without overwhelming your time. Call myself at 903-520-2709. That's 903-520-2709. Or visit Johnson Financial Group on our website, www.jfg.cc. Not .com, www.jfg.cc.
Hi, I'm Katie Gore, the president of Quidel Consulting and Training. There are a lot of myths about affordable housing and the people who need and live in affordable housing. One myth, for example, only people who are unemployed need and live in affordable housing. The reality is that many people in affordable housing actually have working full-time jobs. Teachers, healthcare workers, service employees, people who are essential in our communities. They often struggle to afford rent in so many communities across the nation. And that's what's the beauty about affordable housing. They are providing work in the communities at an affordable rent. Another myth is that affordable housing increases crime. Studies consistently show there is no link between affordable housing and increased crime. In fact, stable housing can reduce crime by providing security and fostering stronger community neighborhoods and building attachment for the people who live in affordable housing. For more information about affordable housing and to walk through some more of those myths, you can find me and my segment on the Women to Watch platform.
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined this week by Kimberly McGlon. And Kimberly is a founder and CEO. She is an author. We'll be talking about her first and most recent book, Build It Boldly. She's also a faculty member at Drexel University. And I believe, are you still working at the Fittler Club for their social impact arm?
I am. I'm still vice president there, one of the vice presidents.
Amazing. You've got a lot of titles.
I do.
Yeah, I think I want to talk about Grant Boulevard and how you kind of made that pivot from your desire to really have positive impact in the area of both the environment and diversity, and particularly helping women who have, you know, been through incarceration, for one thing, employing them. I think it's incredible. So tell me about when the first idea came to you for Grant Boulevard and how you matched fashion with those interests.
You know, I had been at that point, Susan, I had been teaching high school English for about 15 years. And I decided that I wanted to take a little break. And so I took a sabbatical. I worked in a district that afforded us a sabbatical. And I took some time and I did some traveling. I went my first major solo trip alone. I went to East Africa, to Kenya, and I was spending time with women who were survivors of female genital mutilation, and some of them were also HIV positive. And in that trip, in that observation, it opened up my understanding of the ways in which women really are treated so unfairly when it comes to the things we can't really control. And so I came back from that trip and I watched Ava DuVernay's documentary. It just came out that year. This was in 2016. 13th. I hope some of your listeners have seen 13th. If you haven't, it really is really important to understanding even the context of the structure of class and the ways in which race get played into class politics and the ways in which it really undermines the pursuit of the American ideal in terms of the preservation of democracy. So I saw the documentary and I was like, you know what? I want to get involved. I loved being a teacher, but I was really far away in a lot of ways from some profound suffering. And so I started volunteering for a nonprofit that was getting books into prisons. And that led me into the communities of folks who identified as prison activists, even though at the time I didn't identify that way. And I ended up doing a lot of work in prison activism. And then that led me to think about what could I do to show up differently, particularly for women who'd had whose lives had been impacted by the criminal system. And that led me to think about creating jobs. And I thought, well, what can I do? I was a teacher. I wasn't going to be able to get them to teach. And I thought, and what else did I do? What else did I do well? And I don't know, I truly, to this day, I don't quite fully understand why fashion was like the muse that came to me that said, you should use design. And then, so I started studying fashion and learned how horrible it was for the planet. And started thinking about sustainable design before we had real language around sustainable fashion and fast fashion even. And so that was in 2017 was when I launched that company.
2017. Okay. So you've been at it for quite a while.
Yeah, I've been at it for quite a while. Long as my dissertation, my school, my undergrad through to my PhD. It's been like that same amount of time.
Yeah. So this is one of your companies that you see sustaining, and it, by the way, it's here in Philadelphia. And
yep.
How do you get your employees you hire? It's all women.
Right? All women. Yep. We've done it through some really incredible and very strategic partnerships. So thinking about how we can pull together an ecosystem that's supported by the city, that's in the Department of Commerce, that's supported by nonprofits in the city. Like the Philadelphia Skills Initiative, we've done partnerships with Mural Arts. So really just collaborative pushes to think about what might experimentation look like for this community. And that's what it means to build a business, really. It's a lot of research and development. It's a lot of R&D. And it's a lot of figuring out how is your offering aligned with what people want in a moment, right? And so we started out producing garments, cutting, sewing, procuring the fabric, doing all of the grading and the patterning here in Philadelphia for workwear. And then the pandemic happened and our relationship with work changed and getting dressed for work changed. And what I think are to some extent, some lasting cultural ways to some extent. And so then we decided that, you know what, where is the place where women actually have to really first start establishing their energy and preserving themselves? And that's the story of home. So we moved from Grant Boulevard into a rebrand of a company called Noor by Grant Boulevard, same parent company, just a new a new focus and a new focus on how do we support community and personal wellness, emotional wellness for tenacious, kind women, for women who are my friends.
I want to share a quote. You said, "My goal is to inspire diverse audiences towards optimism and agency." And I think about women, particularly when I read that, and I wanted to ask you what you think the greatest challenge for women is today from all backgrounds when it comes to finding that optimistic self and their own agency so that they can pursue, you know, the ventures they were meant to.
Yeah, you know, I think this really does, it goes into the journey I was on and even writing that first book, Build It Boldly, which is, it starts, I think, in recognizing the stories that you've inherited about who you are and what's possible. You know, so how are we examining our early influences and what they've contributed to our understanding of how we're quote unquote supposed to be in the world? And then from there, I think it's about really starting to tease out how are we filtering our inputs, you know, the messaging that we continue to accept about what's possible. And how are we shifting our gaze to look towards other women in particular who are pursuing things that are pioneering and looking to that as a source of energy, as a source of aspiration and inspiration about what we might be called to pursue. So I think for me, that idea of recognizing that, you know, optimism is so much tied to understanding where you've come from and holding on to the idea that there is something positive ahead, even when in the moment, in a day, that's not directly in your immediate line of sight. It's shifting your shoulders so you continue to find it.
How did it feel to get, I know that your company got funding from Beyonce's foundation. Mm-hmm. How exciting was it to find out you got that grant?
It was really exciting. And, you know, and I think it's exciting, of course, because Beyonce has been somewhat of a tastemaker, right? In contemporary culture, what she says and what her team says has value. It is a great signaler that there's perhaps something there. So that was a great boost to our esteem that what we were doing had some value. But, you know, I think in that journey, there were other markers that came to mean more to me, I think. You know, we were able to ship garments to like 43 states. We were able to create living wage work for 7 years. We were able to really build a culture of care in Kensington, which is a neighborhood that is really plagued by so many social and environmental issues. So for me, the success of that company, it really is like, we didn't give up. We kept iterating. We kept figuring out how to move with some sense of being both lean and nimble. And those for me were actually the markers of my success in business.
Do you ever see that particular business moving into retail spaces, or do you have it there now, or is it just online?
It's just online now. And when I think about the future of Noor, it actually is it's growing into even more interest in supporting that kind, tenacious women, that community of women. So I'm really interested in, you know, this book has garnered so much enthusiasm. We just won our first award.
Let's talk about the book.
It all goes together. It broke into the top 1% on Amazon. It's done really well. And the audience has predominantly been these women. So I'm interested in creating more and more in real life community for my someone said, "Kimberly, your network is golden." And they're right. It is. So I'm really interested in bringing these women together who maybe in their neighborhoods or in their professional identities, they don't have proximity. I'm really, really interested in figuring out how do we continue to create opportunities, community spaces, events, experiences that allow just high performing women to shine next to each other. That really excites me.
When and how did you decide, or not how, but what was your main goal in writing this book? Taking on, you know, writing a book is a big project. And, you know, if you think about the women that will read it, what is the most important message you hope they will take away from it, or action that they would take?
Yeah, I wrote the book hoping to drive significant change in the nature of how we think about business, recognizing that for those of us who have been in business or who went to MBA programs, there is never a real focus on what is yet possible when it comes to taking care of people on the planet. And I hope that this book is the guide for women who have the same sense of calling, that there's more yet to be done by business communities globally, and who are very excited to pioneer in their own way about driving the kinds of change that they want to see in the world. And I hope that this book is their guide, and that they feel inspired to find how they're going to leave their mark and build a legacy that will outlast them and make their everyone who comes after them proud of their effort to try to create a more just world.
How do you think that media is doing in messaging today as opposed to even 10 years ago?
Yeah. I mean, that's the media shifted so much even in 5 years, right?
Yes.
I met with a PR company yesterday and they said to me, you know, the idea that you are Black is going to make people, it's going to trigger a little bit of anxiety because of the pushback across sectors around this notion of diversity, equity, and inclusion. You know, because we've moved so far away from thinking about how important diversity is in driving innovation, that there will be audience of people who see you and are they feel anxious. They don't know, you know, what are you going to say? And, you know, what will you trigger that might be quote unquote controversial just by your being? And I met with another company yesterday, another speaker bureau, you know, like these agencies that represent speakers. And they said the same thing. They were like, you know, just so you know, there were places along the Eastern Seaboard that 5 years ago, they would have been really excited to meet you and hear from you. And now they feel a pressure to act with trepidation around showcasing anyone who might visibly present as clearly Black. And he happened to be a cisgender gay white man. And he said, I just want to tell you up front, this is what I'm seeing on my side. And so I think that media in this moment, given that this current kind of cultural calibration is going to be really, really integral to deciding where will we land next when it comes to driving the preservation of the American a take on democracy. And if media is not able to act with courage and to act with leadership and vision, then I am nervous about what that will mean for the very much so the very future of not just our economy, but our democracy. So media has plays a very important role in what we see and what we hear in the protection of the very human spirit that connects us all. And it'll be interesting to see where there is leadership and where there is cowardice.
I'm surprised to hear that. And I'm curious. So this is, you know, a PR firm is telling you this. Have you experienced this yourself? You've been out, I guess, promoting the book and.
Yeah. I don't know that I have. I don't know that I personally have. And I think it's in part because, you know, I think within the greater Philadelphia area, you know, I've been around for a little bit now, and I think that my messaging is pretty consistent and people have a sense of who I am and what I care about. And I also think that for all of us as women, regardless of how we identify, we know that we move through the world always facing barriers, always facing perhaps some reluctance around, you know, is Susan's a woman? Look at her race. Let's look at her age. Let's make decisions about relevance based on those things. And I think that as women in particular, given that most markets have been dominated statistically by male leadership, I think we're conditioned to walk in and sometimes question, you know, how will we be received? And I think that for those of us who are really dedicated to driving change and to leading, that won't really matter. So I had those conversations and I got off of those calls and I talked to my manager, my internal team, and our push has not changed. You know, the things that we want to see, the dreams that we have, we are moving forward with full-fledged enthusiasm about what is possible. And I have always, and I will continue to, both for myself and for other women in particular, encourage us all to protect our optimism. The moment that we lose our optimism is the moment that we accept defeat. And you know, Susan, I'm not the kind of woman who's just really comfortable just settling into a spirit of defeat. So
as you should not be, which is why you are where you are. I just appreciate that so much. I think that sometimes people don't understand that really the value and power of optimism. So in the face of pushback or someone saying what you're doing is wrong, whatever, if you just know in your heart that it's right and you keep, that's always going to win. That's
it might be slow, right? It might be the barrier.
Yeah, it might be slow, yes.
But it's sometimes in the slow, there is the growth, right? Like in this, in that moment where you're like, I really, and I've been through this, where it's like, I really want to be on the cover of Vogue right now. I think what I'm doing is really deserving of a feature in Harper's Bazaar today. In the in-between time, you know, you keep pushing and you keep doing the work, and the body of work is just the body of work.
Is there, I wanted to ask you this, is there an entrepreneur, someone that you admire most when you think about your own career and everything that you're doing? Not that I don't ever want to ask the question, you know, who do you model yourself after? Mm-hmm. You should never do that, mm-hmm. right? You be original Kimberly. But is there someone, a man or a woman, that is an entrepreneur and you've admired the way they've gone about their work with integrity and success?
Yeah, I think there's like that way of thinking about it in the really like the, they do this thing and I really kind of want to do that thing. And for me, I really like how Esther Perel has, she's a podcaster and she's the speaker. And I really like how she has been able to bring people into courageous conversations about hard things. And so as I look ahead to my career and how I want to use my language, that's something that I really, I really admire. And I love how Oprah has become, that's over time, while her people's impressions of her have shifted. There was a very long, long time where she was an arbiter of taste in terms of like, if it's on my list, if it's on the Oprah list, then that means it's tried and true and reliable. And I'm really looking forward to leveraging my language to really figure out how to get people to really recognize the brands, the companies that are doing really remarkable stand-up work on behalf of us all. Pioneering work. And so in those two regards, I admire those two women in particular. But there, you know, Georgia O'Keeffe famously said, I am my own muse. And that continues to resonate with me. You know, Lorraine Hansberry said that to be extraordinary is to be alone. And I think sometimes those of us who are pioneering women, we struggle with some sense of outsiderness or maybe loneliness because we're always pursuing the outer edge. And so, yeah, there's a really diverse, I mean, just so many wonderful voices of women, and particularly in the American tradition, who have not been afraid to go to the ledge and sit there. And among all of them, that is what calls me to action. Is just, I want to continue to not be afraid of the ledge.
I like that. Tell me how you handle anxiety, those times when you're fearful, feeling anxious about, it could be some, you know, it could be, certainly as a mother, I have children, so nothing gives me anxiety more than my children, just wanting everything to be good for them. Yeah. Or with your business, what do you say to yourself? Where do you go to calm your mind?
In the inner landscape of my, I'll say in the outer landscape of my life, for me, I find a lot of medicine in being in nature. I love being in places where there's almost no evidence of human existence. I love gardens. You know, if there's a sculpted place, a really particularly curated experience in nature, I love gardens. I love Winnether. I love the John Barnes has a beautiful arboretum on St. Joe's campus that I discovered. I love Chanticleer. I love garden spaces, and I love hiking. You know, the Wissahickon is a beautiful place to go. There's a meadow there that I love. Same thing with Pennypack, beautiful meadow in Pennypack Park out in Montgomery County. So I love nature, and I love discovering new, if I have a 4-hour block and the weather's nice, I will look for a new garden. If it's within an hour, I will drive to a garden or a public green space that I've never been to and just sit and read. So that for me helps with a feeling of like sometimes the anxiety comes from feeling too big, where it's like, it's my, all my problems and I'm supposed to fix it. And being in nature reminds me of how small I am. Mm. And I think that the other place that I go inwardly is I really am very reliant on, and I depend on my belief that I am provided for and protected by a very kind, loving force. My language is God, that seeks to hold me in a spirit of light and of joy and of discovery and of safety and of provision. And so in my inner landscape, that means for me in this season, I grew up Muslim, but I really enjoy the Bible now. That for me, looking at the model of particularly of how Jesus Christ as a figure, how he navigated being in this world and looking to his example and how he dealt with the poor and the unwanted and the stressed and the grieving, those are places where I go to find comfort. I look to David and I look at the story of David and he helps me with my anxiety too.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I can't think of a better better medicine than nature. And mm-hmm. I love how you said being in a place where there's no human beings whatsoever.
Yeah, no evidence of human existence. Yeah.
That sounds amazing. I remember my father was a big sailor and he mm-hmm. really felt most comfortable alone out on the water by himself. And you made me think of him when you said that. Because I think that's where most of our angst comes from, is the people around us. It's right when we're
it's
alone.
It's caring for other people, particularly as women, this conditioning to care for other people.
Yes.
I think that can create a lot of anxiety. I think there's a lot of anxiety around, you know, the mirroring of other people and what they're doing and is it better? Is it as good as? Is it less than? A lot of comparison, I think, creates a lot of anxiety for us. And I think that being in the built world, it reminds us of all of the needs and all of the to-dos and all of the shoulds. So for me, the expansiveness of being in nature, it removes those barriers to just seeing what's possible. You know, sometimes all the buildings and the cars and the noise, they don't give me the canvas to really imagine. They don't give me the space to really breathe. And so nature opens it up for me to remember that, you know, the beauty of life, if for me anyways, what I'm learning, so much of it is discovered in the quiet and the solitude and the silence and the stillness. And I go to nature to get those things. That's the medicine for me to feeling anxious.
My last question, if there was one, I think people talk about, there's one word for each one of us. I'm a teacher, I'm a builder, I'm a thinker, I'm a philosopher. What do you think your one word is? And maybe you say to me, I don't have one word. I'm all these things.
I think in this particular iteration, I think I'm a designer. I design social interactions, I design garments, I design outlines for longer works, like the book that I, you know, Build It Boldly. I design experiences for people. I design pathways for my daughter. I'm a designer. And I think about how I can use design to benefit the common good. And so in that way, I think I'm a design architect.
There you go. Okay. It's a great way to end the show. I thank you so much, Kimberly, for taking time to share your story. And I hope we can meet in person one day.
I look forward to
it. Philly girls.
Yes, please.
Yes. Thank you. Stay with me as we go into our last break, and I'll be back to close out the show.
Over on our Women to Watch YouTube channel, we have a partner profile series featuring some of the amazing executive women working at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Our latest installment features Dr. Susan Firth. Here's an excerpt from our latest conversation. The goal, I would say, of CHOP is for every child to have a chance at a healthy future. And how does the Research Institute specifically support and help in that goal?
One of our strategic imperatives as an enterprise is to really promote research-driven precision medicine, you know, so diagnostics and therapeutics that are really tailored to an individual's circumstance. And I always add to that research-driven precision medicine that this has to be research-driven precision medicine for everyone. So we've incorporated, we've invested in programs around health equity, research methods, and making sure that as we are pursuing our research and discovery, that we're thinking about how our questions apply to different populations, whether it's where they live, if they're rural or urban, or what their social determinants of health are. So we're trying to incorporate thinking broadly about improving child health to all populations. So we want to help children who are around the world and also in our backyard.
To learn more about Dr. Susan Firth, head over to our Women to Watch YouTube channel for the full interview.
We are CHOP, and we can't wait to show you around. We're the nation's first children's hospital. Now, a care network with more than 50 locations that continues to expand. 3 state-of-the-art research buildings with 1.5 million square feet of space. We have grown from 12 beds 165 years ago to nearly 600 beds and one of the best children's hospitals in the world. We have a level 1 trauma center, 11 floors of patient units, more than 20 operating rooms, first-of-its-kind delivery unit for babies with birth defects, a separate cardiac operative and catheterization suite, and places to learn, like our internationally recognized simulation center. We have trained generations of leaders in the field of pediatrics. We are world leaders in medicine, surgery, and science. One of the top recipients in NIH funding for pediatric research. In this building, pioneers in CAR T therapy, mitochondrial disease, brain tumors, hyperinsulinism, and other rare diseases. Here, groundbreaking work in fetal surgery, genetics and genomics, and neurology. In our newest building, leaders in social determinants of health, clinical informatics and epidemiology, autism, trauma and injury prevention. Our patients come from every state and 115 countries. Meeting these challenges requires the best and the brightest. We are passionate about pediatrics. We are motivated to make a difference in the world and in our community. We are a team. We are CHOP.
Hi, I'm Dawn Zier, CEO, board director, and executive mentor to Fortune 500 executives through my work at the EXCO Group, a firm of experienced CEOs, board directors, and global business leaders who offer real-world experience to help organizations and senior executives grow. At some point early on in your life, you've likely been asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? Some of us know right away, but most of us don't know exactly what we want to do and change our mind multiple times throughout our lives. And that's perfectly okay. Take me, for example. When I look at my career, it's been a non-linear journey and chock full of reinventions. First, I was an engineer, then I switched to marketing. I worked at a phone company, a bank, ran international for a media company, became a CEO of a health and wellness company, and now serve on multiple boards across various industries. Which brings me to one of the biggest lessons I've learned. For many successful people, their career is not a straight line. Let each chapter, each role inform the next, and don't be afraid to pivot. Also, remember that one often needs to make lateral moves rather than take a promotion to prepare for upward mobility. No experience is wasted, and every position you find yourself in is an opportunity to learn, to figure out what you want to do, and perhaps even more importantly, what you don't want to do, and also to define where your true passion lies. Please follow me on LinkedIn at Dawn Zier. And if you're a senior executive looking to grow in your career, visit excoleadership.com to learn more.
That's it, everyone, for another week of Women to Watch. Thanks so much for tuning in. Next week, I'll be sitting down with Sonia Weigel. And Sonia is the former chief people officer for Marinus Pharmaceutical. Thanks so much to our sponsors and our watch team for helping us to bring you the show each and every week. And I'll see you next time.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.